Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. President Trump's former campaign manager learned his fate late yesterday. A federal judge sentenced Paul Manafort to less than 4 years in prison for bank and tax fraud, far, far less than what federal prosecutors recommended. CBS's Paula Reed was at the courthouse.
Before he issued the sentence, the judge signaled that he may be lenient on Manafort because he believed that, quote, 19 to 25 years would be excessive. And he says Manafort has lived a, quote, otherwise blameless life.
The House overwhelmingly passed a broad measure condemning hate in response to controversial comments by Minnesota Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. Before the vote, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi said it's up to Omar to explain what she meant.
I feel confident that her words were not based on any anti-Semitic attitude, but that she didn't have a full appreciation of how they landed.
And House Democrats launch a sweeping probe of President Trump, his longtime associates and business interests, requesting documents from 81 individuals and businesses, charities, campaign, and inaugural committee. The president said the witch hunt continues.
We got 81 letters. There was no collusion. There was a hoax. There was no anything. And they want to do that instead of getting legislation passed. 81 people or organizations got letters. It's a disgrace.
And you can join us. Did Judge T.S. Ellis let Paul Manafort off too easily? Did the House go too far or not far enough in its condemnation of bigotry? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from the White House is NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Mara, it's great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here and so happy that you're hosting.
Yeah, well, it's always a pleasure. Also,
yes, we've known each other since we were two, sort of.
We go
because
way
we started
back.
At NPR when we were five.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think we started NPR before there was even NPR. But anyway, moving on. Let me introduce also from Washington, Tolu Olorunipa, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Tolu, great to have you back on Point.
Hi there. Great to be
here. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Welcome to you as well, Jack. Always great to have you.
Hello, Anthony, Mara, and Tolu.
So I want to start with the Paul Manafort story, a political consultant, the former chairman of the Trump presidential campaign. Yesterday, a federal judge sentenced him to nearly 4 years in prison for financial fraud, among other charges. It's the highest profile case to come out of special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation, although it has nothing to do with allegations of collusion by the Trump campaign. So let's listen for a moment to Paul Manafort's attorney, Kevin Downing. He spoke yesterday with reporters outside the courthouse after Manafort was sentenced to 47 months in prison for bank and tax fraud.
Mr. Manafort finally got to speak for himself. He made clear he accepts responsibility for his conduct. And I think most importantly, what you saw today is the same thing that we had said from day one. There is absolutely no evidence that Paul Manafort was involved with any collusion with any government official from Russia.
So, Mara, I want to start with you. I know you were just on the South Lawn of the White House as President Trump was leaving for the South. Did he respond? What is his response to this sentence?
Well, as usual, he focused on the no collusion mantra, and he said he was very honored. He was very happy that the judge and the lawyer for Paul Manafort said there was no collusion. He, of course, pointed out that Paul Manafort is being sentenced for things that had nothing to do with collusion with Russia. And that's been his message throughout this whole trial and sentencing phase.
Interesting. Now, Tolu, Judge Ellis III said, although Manafort's crimes were very serious, following the sentencing guidelines would have meant an overly harsh punishment. He also said he has lived an otherwise blameless life. What kind of response has there been to this sentence?
Well, I think people did expect that there would be some measure of leniency given Paul Manafort's age. He's almost 60. He's 69 years old, almost 70, and a very lengthy sentence could end up being a death sentence. But the comment that he had lived an otherwise blameless life is getting a lot of pushback from criminal justice experts, from Democrats saying, you know, this is someone who spent years, if not decades, sort of pursuing the political influence game and doing it beyond the bounds of legality. In some cases, he was hiding his income from the U.S. Treasury and not paying taxes. He was, you know, moving money around in various accounts, working with a lot of people that are not the type of people that you'd want to associate with, working overseas with dictators and whatnot. So the idea that he's lived a blameless life is getting a lot of pushback. And the idea that he got a very low sentence given what he was facing based on that assertion of a blameless life is rubbing a lot of people the wrong way. And a lot of watchers are waiting to see what the next judge will do when he comes up for sentencing again next week, and whether or not he will get a harsher sentence, in part because he got such a lenient sentence in this case. Mm.
And Tolu, remind us about the next sentence. This is another case, right? For two conspiracy cases, they carry a maximum of 5 years each. So he could get another 10 years.
Yes, that's right. He's going to be facing a different judge in a different case, and he is going to be sentenced. It could be as much as 10 years altogether. Not expecting that much, but based on this current case that he just received, there's going to be a lot of focus on hearing whether or not the judge sentences him to serve his time concurrently with his current sentence or stacks it on top of the 4 years that he already got. That judge has been much more harsh towards Paul Manafort, in part because the reason why Manafort is in jail right now and had his bail revoked was because the judge found that he had been witness tampering and he had not actually fulfilled his cooperation agreement. So that judge is much more likely to want to throw the book at him, I think, because he's shown sort of a contempt for the justice system, saying that he was going to cooperate and then failing to do so, lying to investigators even after pleading guilty. So he does face a potential for a harsher sentence in this upcoming sentencing, but we'll have to wait and see whether or not that is a sentence is stacked on top of what he's already serving, or whether that's something that he can serve concurrently with his current sentence.
Jack Beatty, I'm reading a quote by Barbara McQuaid of the New York Times. She's a former U.S. attorney who teaches law at the University of Michigan. And she said of Manafort's sentencing yesterday, it's atrociously low. Many judges do sentences leniently in white-collar cases, but dropping all the way from 19 years to 4 years is absurd. What's your reaction to the sentence?
Yes, King Lear had a comment on that. He said, plate sin with gold, and the strong lance of justice hurtless breaks. And a public defender in Brooklyn commented in a tweet that his client yesterday was offered 36 to 72 months for stealing $100 worth of quarters from a laundry. That's the American justice system. And it was of all people, Roy Cohn, the Mr. Trump's mentor, who made, I think, the apposite quote about this sort of thing. We summon him from the grave. I don't want to know what the law is, Cohn once said. I want to know who the judge is. And T.S. Eliot, Ellis III, Princeton, Harvard, Oxford, is a member of the American elite. And so looking across at Mr. Manafort, he could say, otherwise blameless life. And his Frank Foer's classic comment on that, blameless life. He spent a career lobbying for arms for clients who burned children alive. He represented gangsters who broke democracies and destroyed health systems. He literally created corruption as we know it in Washington, end quote.
Well, but those are not crimes. Yeah.
Yeah. Say more about that, Mara.
Yeah. Those themselves are not crimes. I do think that Jack is onto something. And I think that there were two big debates that this sentence sparked. One was, did Paul Manafort get the sentence that he deserved? That's one debate. And of course, as Tolu said, we're not finished. We got to wait till see what he gets next week. But the other debate was the huge disparity between the way white-collar criminals are treated and the way that other people are treated for stealing coins from a laundromat, voting by mistake. There's a woman who got 5 years for voting by mistake more than Paul Manafort. So that this is going to feed the real populism that's coursing through the American political debate that the system is rigged. If you're rich, powerful, white collar, you get off. If you are poor, person of color, committed some small but maybe something that wasn't a white collar crime, you get punished much more harshly.
Yeah, it's an important point, Mara, and a really important debate. I want to move on because there's a lot more news this week. So I want to talk about the vote in the House yesterday, a subject that's been tying up congressional Democrats in knots this week. It started with controversial statements made by Minnesota freshman Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who suggested, among other things, that backers of Israel exhibit dual loyalty. Many people regarded that as anti-Semitic. She's made previous statements along these lines that have landed badly. So yesterday, the House voted to condemn hate in all its form. And Tolu, let me come to you. What was it? What did this measure actually say, and what didn't it say?
Well, the statement had some pretty direct language when it comes to anti-Semitism, really rejecting it and rejecting the type of language that Representative Omar trafficked in, which basically alluded to the idea that certain people have allegiance to a foreign country being Israel. And they said that kind of language is unacceptable. But it was broader than that because it also talked about anti-Muslim bigotry. It also talked about anti-LGBT action and activity. It talked about white supremacy, and it ended up being sort of a catch-all resolution against all forms of hate. And I think that's why you did see some Republicans even vote against it, because they believed that it was not specific enough for the moment. You did have all the Democrats voting in favor of that resolution, including Representative Omar, and they were able to sort of figure out a compromise. And I think that's what they were able to do with that resolution.
Tolu, hold a thought. We're going to come back and pick up this conversation about the House measure after the break. Listeners, we're talking about the week in review. What do you make? What do you make of the Paul Manafort sentence? What do you make of the House vote condemning bigotry in all its forms, but not necessarily calling out Congresswoman Omar? We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. And before the break, we were talking about the week in review, the news this week. And we were talking specifically about the vote by the House to condemn bigotry in all its forms. This followed statements by freshman Congresswoman Ilhan Omar that some regarded as anti-Semitic. So here's Florida Democratic Congressman Ted Deutch, who is Jewish, criticizing the House measure as being too broad.
Anti-Semitism is worthy of being taken seriously on its own. It's worthy of being singularly called out. Jews control the world. Jews care only about money. Jews have dual loyalty and can't be patriotic members of the country in which they live. Words matter. For generations, they have had dangerous consequences for me, for my family, and for my people. This shouldn't be so hard.
With me are Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, Tolu Olorunipa, White House reporter for The Washington Post, and Mara Liasson, NPR correspondent as well. Mara, the president has responded and has responded to this House vote. What did he say?
Yeah, I think this was really the biggest news out of his comments today as he left the White House to go to Alabama and Mar-a-Lago. He said he thought the Democratic vote, the Democrats' measure was a disgrace. He said the Democrats have become an anti-Israel party and an anti-Jewish party. And he repeated it twice. And this is going to be part of his branding. They're the party of socialism, late-term abortion, open borders, and now they are the anti-Jewish party. And what's so interesting about this is that this is something that the Democrats are really going to have to wrestle with, because up until now, when you talk to Republicans, they all say Donald Trump could be defeated by a generic Democrat. But if the Democrats nominate someone who's too far to the left and can be painted by the president as someone who is, you know, socialistic, anti-Jewish, et cetera, then we can win. Trump can win. And so far, the Democrats are completely cooperating.
Interesting. Jack Beatty, what's your response? What are you seeing in this difficult subject for Nancy Pelosi, as Mara suggested, possibly for Democrats in general?
Well, three presidential candidates essentially attacked the attacks on Representative Omar, Sanders, Warren, and Harris. They said, "Oh, it's going too far," which is sort of illustrative of Mara's point and the danger the Democrats are in situations like this. You know, the resolution itself is the first time Congress has condemned anti-Muslim bigotry. It's included in there. Came close in 2016, but Republicans turned it back. So that's noteworthy. And it's noteworthy that in the declaration, the statement, they instance the history of anti-Semitism, not just here but abroad, the Dreyfus case, where a French colonel was accused of dual loyalty to Germany because he was Jewish and framed and sent to prison. But it is a dangerous moment when the Democratic Party can't stand up and on its own, as Representative Deutsch said, condemn this vile hatred, which last year in the United States we had our worst anti-Semitic incident at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. The anti-Semitic incidents are rising every year, and that the Democratic Party couldn't say to its progressive members, look, hold off. We'll have a separate resolution on all these other bad things, including discrimination against Pacific Islanders. That's included. We'll do that. But all by itself, we're going to condemn anti-Semitism, and we're going to send a message to Representative Omar. You have a predilection for this. This is now the third time you've done this. Where are you going with this? Are you trying to create, you know, make anti-Zionist, anti-Semitic speech sort of the new norm? They should have stood against it, and they couldn't because of the pressure from within their own caucus.
Yeah, Jack, I mean, it was interesting to hear Nancy Pelosi saying, I feel confident that her words were not based on any anti-Semitic attitude, but that she didn't have a full appreciation of how they landed. So she's trying to walk a fine line there. But you're saying perhaps being, what, somewhat disingenuous?
Well, I just think that it if someone told you, would the Democratic Party come out and you know, denounce anti-Semitism all by itself. You'd say, of course.
Right.
But the because this is a new representative, because she's a member of the progressive group, the new people, you know, there's a certain protection for her. But this now is the third time.
Right.
And where is she going to go with this? We'll just have to see.
Well, before we move on, I want to take a couple of calls on this very subject. Let's go to Anne, who's calling from St. Michael's, Maryland. Anne, you're on the air. Thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Hi. I appreciate this conversation that you're having today. Obviously, bigotry in all forms is to be condemned. But I think Congressman Omar is a very brave young woman. The U.S. has long been blind to Israel, to the illegal settlements, to the treatment of the Palestinians, the blockades. And I think she's very gutsy. and I say bravo. While her words may not be the most eloquent for this position, it's something that needs to be talked about, and to criticize Israel is not being anti-Semitic.
All right, Anne.
That's not what she did.
Yeah, go ahead, Mara. Respond to
Anne. I think it's really – I think that there have been so many people, many, many Democrats in Congress who have done all the things that that listener just listed – criticize the Israeli government, criticize their policies to the Palestinians, been vocal about this for years and years. That's not what she did. She said supporters of Israel, individual people, I'm assuming she meant American Jews, have an allegiance to a foreign country. She didn't just talk about Israeli policies. So this is something quite different. The strong opposition to the Netanyahu government, to Israeli policies, that is not new. She is not the first person who did that, and that isn't even what she did. This was very directed against American Jews when she said supporters of Israel have an allegiance to a foreign country, and that is an age-old anti-Semitic trope.
So let's go to one more call on this. Let's take Joshua, who's calling from West Des Moines, Iowa. Joshua, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. My question/comment is, I guess I'm a little confused on why Representative Omar's comments are being blown out of proportion. I feel like just criticizing the state of Israel doesn't equate you to being racist against Jews. I just feel that she was just making a point. She never said anything about Jews individually, so I don't understand why their resolution even needs to come into play.
All right, Josh, I want to come back to this point. I think Mara expressed it pretty well. Tolu, let me give you a crack at sort of responding to Joshua's question. What do you think?
Yeah, this does sort of speak to sort of a generational split in the party to a certain extent. You do have some of these newer, younger Democrats who are not playing by the rules that have been set in the past and are tiptoeing past the line of political correctness on specific issues, and this being one of the most explosive ones. But there are several issues where the young progressive Democrats are looking to push the party pretty far. And when it comes to the U.S. relationship with Israel, there is a push to, you know, revisit that relationship, to not have it just be sort of a given that there will be full support for the Israeli government, and to focus more on some of the things that the Netanyahu government has done, including, you know, building the settlements. And we have just heard from Netanyahu within the past few weeks that he does not believe in a two-state solution. He said that that would be very dangerous. So there is a push to increase the number of options on the table for the Congress. I do think that Representative Omar's comments distracted from that broader discussion because they're seen within that historical construct of sort of age-old tropes, as Mara said. But I do think that there is a desire by these newer, younger Democrats to change the discussion and to have some questions about whether or not the ironclad commitment of the U.S. government to the Israeli government should be should not be challenged and should not be changed based on what we've seen out of the Israeli government and specifically the Netanyahu administration.
Mara,
yes,
go ahead, Mara.
Many administrations, including the Obama administration, was not a lockstep supporter of the Netanyahu government as Donald Trump is. And if Democrats can't tell the difference between criticizing Israeli policy, questioning a kind of blind loyalty to anything that the Netanyahu government does, if they can't tell the difference between that and criticizing individual Jews, and when you say that supporters of Israel pledge allegiance to a foreign government, that is something quite different. You are just playing – Democrats are just playing right into the hands of Republicans and Donald Trump. This was a great day yesterday for the president and all of his supporters. This is what they want the Democrats to do. And the fact that she's now done this three times doesn't seem to understand the difference between criticizing American Jews and the Israeli government, I think it's going to be a problem for Democrats politically.
So let's move on and talk about the House Judiciary Committee launching this week a sweeping investigation into President Trump and his inner circle. The panel wants documents from 81 individuals, federal agencies and entities. The individuals include the president's sons, Don Jr. and Eric Trump. And the investigation is focusing on whether the president obstructed justice, whether he violated campaign finance laws, and whether he abused his powers among among other things. Jack, I'd love to get your take on this. Tell us more about the scope of this investigation, where you think it leads.
Well, it seems to lead everywhere.
Yeah.
81 people and institutions. And the president is making something of that. He's saying, you know, this is overreach, overkill. And apparently the Democrats are thinking twice about calling in his children to ask them questions. So it's a big process with lots of tentacles. But if you look at the latest polls, I see 59% of Americans do not want Mr. Trump impeached. When Richard Nixon left the White House, that 59% of Americans thought he should have been impeached. So the case for impeachment has a long way to go, and the predicate has to be built up piece by piece. And these hearings will help that. But, you know, we hope the hearings don't sort of just gloss over what one of the things we learned about Paul Manafort, that in early August 2016, he and his man, Rick Gates, met with a Russian operative in a cigar bar in Manhattan, and he handed the Russian 75 pages of campaign polling data, which presumably or speculatively the Russians used to target voter groups with their efforts to elect Mr. Trump. Are we going to hear more about that? Is that just going to go away? And when the president says no collusion, boy, that sure looks like collusion, doesn't it? And yet it's the Democrat. If you've got to investigate one thing, I hope they get to that.
Well, speaking of building up a case for possible impeachment, let's listen to New York Democratic Congressman Jared Nadler, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. He told ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos on Sunday that he believes President Trump obstructed justice. But he said before the House could consider impeachment, it first must conduct this thorough investigation.
Before you impeach somebody, you have to persuade the American public that it ought to happen. You have to persuade enough of the opposition party voters or the Trump voters that you're not just trying
to steal. It's a very high bar.
Yeah, it is a very high bar, that you're not just trying to steal the last election, to reverse the results of the last election. We may not get there. But what we have to do is protect the rule of law.
So, Mara, there's Congressman Nadler saying we've got to protect the rule of law. Is there a risk, though, of overreach here that this could backfire on Democrats?
Sure. There's a huge risk, and Nadler knows it, and that's why he just said what he did.
Right.
Investigating the president is the constitutionally prescribed role of Congress, or doing oversight of the executive branch. And that's what he's doing. Now, impeachment is a whole other thing. First of all, it's a political decision. And like he said, you don't want to do it unless you have bipartisan buy-in. And also, there's going to be a question of timing. These investigations, I assume, are going to take a long time because Democrats are trying to lay out a case bit by bit of what the president did, how he abused power, how he might have obstructed justice, how he might have violated other laws. That takes time. Pretty soon, we're going to get into election season. And there's going to be a big question. Should you move to impeach the president before an election when voters, the most legitimate Democratic thing we have in America, can weigh in on their own? I think you're going to hear – first you heard Democrats saying we can't discuss impeachment. We have to wait for the Mueller report. They're not waiting for the Mueller report to do investigations. But now you're going to – I think eventually you're going to hear Democrats saying – too close to the election. Let the voters decide. We have laid out a ton of evidence for them to consider.
Mm. Well, let's hear from a voter in Iowa. Kimberly is calling from Washington, Iowa, with a comment on this subject. Kimberly, it's good to have you. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. My comment is this. Many of us voted for Donald Trump. Many of us are sick and tired of what the Democrats are pushing as far as murder of our babies and of American children and keeping the borders open to where we're not safe. So my question is this, is why do the Democrats keep trying to pull our attention away from the idea of what is really important in America? And let me tell you, my first child is from a rape. I kept her. I don't regret it. My little guy was diagnosed with Down syndrome while he was in my womb. I kept him. He's gifted and talented. He is in a STEM program for gifted and talented because the doctors trying to tell me I should get an abortion, that child would never have lived. So let me tell you, we're tired of the probes against Donald Trump, and we're tired of everybody fighting the good that he's trying to accomplish. And yesterday,
Kimberly, I think we got it, and I want to give our panelists a chance to respond, but we hear you loud and clear. You're a supporter of Trump and many of President Trump and many of his policies, and you're concerned about the probes. Tolu, there's an example of, we were talking a moment ago with Mara about the risk, I guess, of overstepping by Democrats. There's a voter who is already saying Democrats are going too far.
Yeah, the president's base is very strong in support. If you look at polls, the president has a pretty high approval rating among the Republican base. Then you have the Democratic base that wants these investigations. They want aggressive oversight, and some would say that the 2018 election was a referendum on that level of oversight. But there is the middle, and the Democrats have to make sure they do not lose folks in the middle by going too far, by being seen as extreme on abortion, on immigration, on several different issues that the president is very much trying to message to his supporters and to suburban voters and to moderates that the Democrats are far too extreme to take a chance on them. So they have to balance that and make sure they don't get painted with that brush.
Listeners, this is our week in review, our panel discussion. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. In other news this week, 23 people died in Alabama after the worst tornado outbreak in the United States in nearly 6 years. NBC's Gabe Gutierrez spoke with Cora Jones, who lost her parents, her brother, and seven other extended family members.
That's an image I would never get out of my head.
You found your dad.
I found my dad. Why this had to happen like this? To everybody that you know and love. At one time.
In other news, R&B singer R. Kelly denied allegations of criminal sexual abuse in an explosive interview with Gayle King of CBS News.
I didn't do this stuff. This is not me. I'm fighting for my life. Y'all killing me with this.
And Alex Trebek, host of the TV quiz show Jeopardy, announced he's battling stage 4 pancreatic cancer. In his somber yet lighthearted announcement, he vowed to fight and survive.
Truth told, I have to, because under the terms of my contract, I have to host Jeopardy for 3 more years. So help me, keep the faith, and we'll win. We'll get it done.
You can join the conversation. What other stories were on your radar this week? What's moving your world? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm joined by national political correspondent Mara Liasson, Washington Post White House reporter Tolu Olurunipa, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. And panelists, distinguished panelists, let me ask you a little bit about this story. Michael Cohen, President Trump's former lawyer and fixer, was back on Capitol Hill this week, this time providing testimony before congressional investigators behind closed doors. Mara, let me come to you about this. What do we know, if anything, about what members of Congress wanted to hear and what they did hear from Michael Cohen?
Well, we don't know exactly what they heard, but they seemed happy. Adam Schiff, the chairman of the committee, came out and said all our questions were answered, or none of them were unanswered, something like that. We know that Michael Cohen said that he was going to provide some documents to show that his testimony, when he lied to Congress previously about how long the negotiations went on between the Trump Organization and Russians about building Trump Tower in Moscow, how long they went on, that testimony was reviewed in advance by the president's lawyers. In other words, they knew what he was going to say. He previously had testified publicly that the president encouraged him to lie to Congress without directly saying lie to Congress, but he got the message from the president that the president wanted the story to be that the negotiations ended well before the election, when in fact they did not. Mm. So that's presumably what he showed the committee.
All right. And Tolu, there was a related story. CNN reported this week that President Trump pressured his then chief of staff, John Kelly, and White House attorney Don McGahn to grant security clearances to his daughter, Ivanka. This follows reporting by The New York Times last week that he tried to do the same thing for his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, despite concerns by intelligence officials. How is the White House responding to these latest revelations?
They aren't. They are saying we do not talk about security clearances, even though there was a point last year where they went into lengthy discussions of security clearances because there were all of these reports that not only Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, but several top White House officials were unable to get security clearances or were operating with interim security clearances. When President Trump was asked about this by The New York Times a few weeks back, he said, no, that I don't get involved in security clearances. I don't involve myself in that. And if this reporting is true, then that means the president was flatly lying to the American public. Now, there is a fight with Congress right now. The Congressional Oversight Committee has been trying to get documents out of the White House for several months about the security clearance process. The White House has been rejecting those efforts. And this could ultimately be the first subpoena that is sent from Congress to the White House demanding documents because there is a sense that the White House has something to hide and they have not been upfront not only with the American people but also with the representatives in Congress about what has been happening with the security clearance process. Part of the news that was very interesting from this reporting said that John Kelly, the former chief of staff, wrote contemporaneous memos basically saying and documenting that he was not okay with the idea of overruling the intelligence agencies and granting a security clearance to the president's son-in-law over the objection of the officials that normally make that decision. And if that is true, and if those documents ultimately come to light, it would definitely undermine the president's denials from the past, and it would put a lot of egg on the face of the White House that publicly denied the president getting involved in the security clearance process when, in fact, the reporting shows that he did.
Mm. Let's talk about the situation on the southern border, the Trump administration's contention that this amounts to a national emergency. So on Wednesday, Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen testified before the House Homeland Security Committee, and the committee's chairman, Mississippi Democratic Congressman Benny Thompson, pressed her on family separation and the detention of children.
Are we putting children in cages as of today?
Children are processed at the border facility stations that you've been at. Some of
the seen the cages. I just want you to admit that the cages exist.
Sir, they're not cages.
What are they?
Areas of the border facility that are carved out for the safety and protection of those who remain there while they're being processed.
So that was Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen testifying before Congress. She implored House Democrats to confront what she called a humanitarian catastrophe. Jack, what are you seeing in this story and where it goes from here and sort of, you know, how Congress needs to respond to this case that the Trump administration is making?
Well, it turns out that the president is right. There is a crisis at the border. The New York Times documented it this week. There's an unprecedented surge of migrants from Central America, families. They are not, however, the kind of invade. You know, it's not a prop. It's not the problem that we used to have in the past of single men crossing the border looking from often Mexicans looking for work here.
No, these people actually want to be arrested and stopped. They want asylum. They're asylum seekers. The president's nostrum for this is a wall. It would do nothing to deal with the current crisis. It's an imaginary crisis. That part of it is imaginary, and his solution would do nothing for it. Meanwhile, we have this new phenomenon of 76,000, I think, in February, people, families, many of them, looking for asylum, and we have no infrastructure to deal with it. Doris Meisner, the immigration official under President Clinton this morning on NPR, was just saying, you know, we're not prepared for this. Policy has not caught up with the reality on the ground. And the president, far from, you know, trying to do that, catch up with the reality on the ground by surging judges, by, you know, working through the caseloads and so on, he's still all about his wall, which is not where the problem is.
So, Mara, there was this news, Jack made reference to it, 76,000 unauthorized border crossings in February. That's the highest level in 11 years, if I'm reading this correctly. What does this do to the debate and the president's case?
I think when the debate is generally about border security, the president wins. When the debate becomes about a wall, the president loses. So what's happening right now, even though he's saying we have a crisis at the border, okay, maybe you need more judges, more detention centers, et cetera. And that some of that was actually in the funding bill that he was given that he didn't like because it didn't have any money for a wall. So would the wall be the solution? That's what we're actually arguing about. And it sounds like Congress will not be able to stop the president from declaring a national emergency using his powers that Congress gave him to use certain kinds of funds without Congress appropriating them, because they're not going to be able to override his veto. Then this whole thing will be fought out in the courts. And the courts will decide if the president's declaration of a national emergency in order to build a wall on the border is something that is constitutional or not.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of that. Of course, the president has used his executive powers to call for a national emergency. Here's Maine Republican Susan Collins, who's one of a handful of GOP senators who say they'll vote against President Trump's national emergency declaration. She told CNN yesterday that she believes more Republicans will follow suit.
We just cannot countenance having the president unilaterally shift vast sums of money around for which he does not have the authority to do, in my judgment, under the National Emergencies Act or other laws. He does have some authority to shift funds, but mm-hmm. not to this extent, particularly after Congress turned down his request.
Tolu, that was Republican Maine Senator Susan Collins. The idea being that there's only a handful of Republicans who are opposed to this national emergency declaration by the president. Are more going to follow, in your view?
I would expect more to follow. There have been several that have spoken out and have voiced their concerns, even if they haven't publicly said that they're going to vote against the president. Some have urged the president to pull this national security emergency declaration and go a different route. I think the president is trying to reduce the number of defections from the Republican Party by making calls, by sending the vice president and other officials over to Capitol Hill to try to make the case. But at the end of the day, these are Republicans who do not believe that you should cede the power of the purse to the White House and allow the White House to decide how to spend money when Congress has made a different decision about the spending. So you do have senators like Marco Rubio, like Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, who's already announced that he's not going to vote in favor of this. Pat Roberts in Kansas has also, you know, written about his concerns. So you could see another handful of Republicans come out against the president and vote in a way that leads to an embarrassment for the White House, which would be the president having to sign his very first veto on his signature issue, which is the wall and the border. This is not something the White House wants, but it doesn't seem like they can stop it at this point. And the president would have to do that veto. There are not the votes, it seems, to override the president's veto. So as Mara said, this is something that's likely to be decided by the courts. But it is still politically embarrassing for the president to have a bipartisan vote against his national security declaration.
I want to spend just a few minutes, folks, talking about the 2020 presidential race. Who's in and who's out? Because there was a little news this week. We learned this week that Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio, won't run. Hillary Clinton won't run. That wasn't really a surprise. Former Attorney General Eric Holder won't run. Joe Biden, the former vice president, seems to be moving closer to running. And two Western governors, Jay Inslee of Washington and former Colorado Governor Jay Hickenlooper, will run. So, Mara, let me come to you. How is this race shaping up? And I'm particularly interested in this idea of Inslee and Hickenlooper, because these are Westerners, they're governors, they actually get things done. Do they bring something new to the table?
They do, although they have very low name recognition and they're not necessarily in the top tier. But in general, people have looked outside of Washington for presidential nominees because they've already been chief executives.
Right.
But I think it's hard to categorize this field into neat lanes, but I think there are a couple that you could talk about. There's the kind of big battle of the two progressive giants, Warren and Sanders. You could look at this, what you might call the moderate Midwestern lane. I think that's not a very precise term, but it doesn't have Sherrod Brown in it anymore. It does have Amy Klobuchar, and it probably will have Joe Biden. And I think when you talk to Democrats, they fall into two groups. One, people who want the next Barack Obama. They want to fall in love. Democrats often want to do that with their candidates. And the other group are people who want to win. They're looking for someone who can win Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Ohio, the four most important states. And they're looking for someone who has the experience and the stature and kind of the gravitas to be the kind of president that they don't think Donald Trump is. So those are the kind of two groups. And I think what's interesting is how many of the people who might have been in that centrist lane are not running.
Yeah, interesting. Tolu, what do you see? I mean, one of the big sort of questions that everybody's waiting to answer, I mean, Joe Biden seems to be inching closer to yes, and if so, he'd be the big sort of 800-pound gorilla in that sort of middle moderate group that Mara was describing. What do you think? I mean, I don't know if you're a betting man, but is he going to get in?
It does seem like all signs are pointing in that direction. We also had Mayor Mike Bloomberg bow out this week, so that does leave that moderate lane a little bit more open for someone like Joe Biden to go in. My colleague had a story this week about Joe Biden's views on busing in the 1970s and how that long history and that long record that Joe Biden has after more than 30 years in Congress could come back to haunt him. Some of the things he said about school integration back then, if read today, would be seen as very jarring and very politically incorrect. And he's likely going to have to reckon with his record. And I think that's part of what he's grappling with, seeing the new progressive wing of the Democratic Party that's ascendant and looking at his past record and trying to figure out whether or not there's a lane for him to run in 2019. I think that's part of the reason he hasn't jumped in quite yet. He does have all of the infrastructure. He has all the campaign aid. He has a strong polling numbers that would lean towards a run, but it's his personal decision that he still has to make, and he has to decide whether or not he thinks there's a place for him in the modern Democratic Party and whether or not he can stand by his long record, which includes some areas and some issues where Democrats are not too comfortable with now, mm-hmm. on criminal justice and other issues, and whether or not he can stand by that and defend that in 2019. That's the big decision, and I'm not sure he's made it yet, but if he does, there will be a campaign in waiting ready for him to jump in.
All right, that's the big story we'll be watching. Washington Post White House reporter Tolu Olunariipa, so glad to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And Mara Liasson, NPR correspondent. Great to have you. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
And On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, have a great weekend and thank you.
Thank you, Anthony.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits, so you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation, and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.